Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2023. I am one of your hosts, Phil Liskov.
I am your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your regular host, somebody who wrote a column about what happened in this movie and the Wall Street Journal as like challenged for views.
Interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that that was a thing.
No, listen. Nobody. Yeah. This movie's fictional. To be clear, this did not happen. But I was watching it, being like, if this was written about in a newspaper today, people would be writing about Matt Damon having to leave whatever this boarding school is, and being like,
"Oh, for sure,
it's a cancel culture story, isn't it? Really, a cancel culture story."
And that voice you hear is Michael Hobbs with us today to talk about School Ties. He's the co-host of Maintenance Phase and If Looks Could Kill. Thank you so much for being here today, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
So I don't believe any of us had seen this film prior to recording this episode. Am I correct in that assessment, Michael? Had you seen this film?
No, and it is not good. It is I immediately upon finishing it, I was like, I am really going to struggle to talk about this movie for an hour, because it's like, it's just not interesting. There's nothing like, it's not even bad in like an interesting, like critiquable way. It's just like kind of, it's just so forgettable.
It's strange that, like, I agree with you 100%. I'll also say that it weirdly does have a bit of a footprint. Like, I do feel as though it's a movie that, and most of it, I think, is because
they cast all the boys. They cast all the boys in Hollywood. Yeah.
The cast is banging. That's the only thing you can say about this movie. Like, they nailed it on the casting.
They did. It's really strange, too, because I remember, until recently didn't know this film was about anti-Semitism. I just thought it was just a boarding school movie.
Yeah, somehow I knew this.
Okay,
as the one person, as like the one person, I did not meet a Jewish person until I was, had left college, until I was in my 20s. So somehow I knew this movie was about, yeah, you're the first Jewish person I've met, Phil. This is I somehow knew this movie was about how anti-Semitism is bad, but like, and it is like kind of about that, but it's mostly about like cheating. I don't know.
It's, you know, as I was watching it, I was thinking about, for the first thing that came to mind is Emily notoriously dislikes boarding school movies.
So I figured out why too. Go ahead.
Oh, great. And as I hit play on this about 15 minutes in, I was like, oh man, this is, Emily's really not gonna like this one. Like, this is all of the boarding school tropes, just all dialed up to 11, and none of them are particularly interesting. It's like someone took Dead Poets Society and removed all the interesting stuff, and instead you're just left with like weird kind of like, oh, they cheated and white people are assholes. Like, I don't know. It's
wait, what are the tropes that you hate about boarding school movies, Emily? How does this personify them?
I gotta say, Dead Poets Society, I was never a huge fan of, but every boarding school movie I watch in 1992, I bump it up a half star because I'm like, well, it's better than this.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I also do not like that movie, and I also like it a lot more having seen School Ties.
I mean, I think Scent of a Woman's better than this movie, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I actually, yes. I have it ranked lower than Scent of a Woman on my 1992 rankings. I mean, some of it is like, I did not grow up in this world. This is a thing I talk about a lot. But like, there's two kinds of people who interact with a lot of people who went to like Ivy League schools. There are people who did not themselves. There are people who buy into the fascination around them. And there are people who just sort of get very angrily dismissive of that, and I'm one of the latter. I'm just like, I don't understand why we care about any of this is so stupid. But watching this movie made me realize, okay, boarding schools are a thing I just cannot relate to. But then we saw the scene where they met all the girls from the girls' boarding school, and I was like, oh well, listen, I could fuck with like hanging out with a bunch of girls and we all have like adventures with homoerotic undertones. That would be great, wonderful. I think it's just that these movies
did they make that movie
boys.
Has that movie been made?
They made some girl boarding school movies. Mona Lisa Smile is about college, but kind of has that. Mona Lisa Smile is the only movie that is simultaneously too gay and not gay enough. It's just so strange.
I mean, there is Lost in Delirious, which I think I texted to you, which is a good movie, which is also about college, though. So I don't think that that's a boarding school. Yeah. It is interesting how, like, boy boarding school movies are a thing. Were they a thing before Dead Poets Society? Was that the one that kind of everyone was like, oh, we should just keep doing this?
I don't
know enough about
boarding school movies. I think that this all stems from the book A Separate Piece, which had a movie made of it, but is very much like...
Interesting.
Yeah, it's this classic book, especially among the boomers, that is set in a boarding school and is about like confronting prejudice and stuff.
Sure.
So.
This is also like why people like submarine movies.
Yes.
The same. They fail. I was thinking the only movie that fails the Bechdel test more spectacularly than School Ties is like Crimson Tide. Like, that's the only category that's worse on this measure.
Listen, I think there should be a movie about a bunch of girls in December.
Would watch.
Hell yeah, do it.
Yeah. Why aren't you writing that, Emily?
Yeah.
Because I'm on strike. But
I forgot.
Listen, I know that we can't talk about it in front of Michael, who's the head of Artisan Entertainment. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm in charge of ending the writer's strike. I've decided not to. I just want
clear.
You should have put that in the intro.
It does feel like boarding school movies have evolved into like murder mysteries. Like, I do feel like there's a fair amount of books and television shows about like a murder happens at a boarding school. Which is fine. I have no problem with that trope. But this movie, more than anything, just sort of, it's sort of about class to some degree, like the haves and have nots. But it doesn't really examine that in any really interesting way. It's just sort of like, we don't like this guy because he doesn't have money and we do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the like, when I was thinking of like my notes of like how to fix this movie, I was thinking like, the main character should have like a personality of some kind or like a noticeable flaw, or like, I don't even need him to have an arc, but it's just, he's like this perfect person and he's just like super cool all the time. And then everyone else is just like a rabid anti-Semite and just like,
I mean, his flaw is
shouting
he's Jewish,
slurs,
Michael.
And there's like a fucking swastika flag. And it's just like, it falls into this weird category, I think, like Mona Lisa Smile, of this like ideological pornography where all you're doing is like, look how far we've come. Mm-hmm. Look how bad anti-Semitism was, and look how anti-Semitic we were. And like, okay, but like, this movie doesn't say anything all that interesting about anti-Semitism. I don't think that I like learned anything about how anti-Semitism operated.
I would also argue the current state of America, we might not have learned as much as we think
we've
learned about anti-Semitism.
Maybe it's not a look how far we've come movie necessarily anymore.
Like, the years post-Cold War, I talk about this a lot in my writing, that is sort of this end of history cinema. Sure. You know, people are like, a book that Michael is now acquainted with, Francis Fukuyama's The End of History, people were like sort of taking that idea and making movies out of it. Like,
yeah,
we have won. Capitalism has won. Right. Liberalism has won. We're fine. Everything's great. And then like the movies were like, well, is that all there is? You know, I think The Matrix is the one of those movies that's endured because it ends up having a lot more going on than that. But like, there's also this attitude in 90s cinema of a lot of these movies that are like, well, we've defeated prejudice once and for all.
Right.
And it's, and if you talk to anybody who was not like a white straight guy, they would be like, actually, no, I don't know if that's true. But the movies were like, nope, anti-Semitism is gone. We got rid of it.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
It's really interesting because like I was watching last night the Jane Fonda HBO documentary, Jane Fonda and Five Acts, which I'd never seen before. This will tie in a second. And I was watching the whole portion of the whole Vietnam thing with her. Right. And as I'm watching this, I'm thinking about the, you know, the various rulings that have happened in the Supreme Court over the last week or so. Right. And how there's this moment sort of in the 60s where this country is really radically moving, right? Like doing all sorts of things in terms of feminism, in terms of, you know, in terms of race, in terms of all sorts of things. And Emily is totally right that in the 90s, you have this stream of movies where it's like, well, we did it, right? Like it's all fixed. It's all great. And now it just feels like there's a large portion of this country that wants to take us back to the 50s, like literally rewind all of the things that existed, which is why it's interesting to watch this film to some degree through that context of like, the rise in anti-Semitism that's going on right now. This movie's no good. I'm not riding for this movie, but it did make me sort of think about how, you know, being a Jewish person was never a thing for most of my life that I was at all concerned about. Mm-hmm. I had one weird moment of, I grew up in Toronto, Michael. So, you know, as you can imagine, Canada doesn't have as much rampant issues as there are here, but as someone etched a swastika into my locker in junior high.
Really? Holy shit.
Which is a weird thing. Never found out who the person was. Immediately went to the principal. They immediately, you know, fixed it and never thought of, really ever thought about it again. So there is sort of this, and then in sort of the wake of Trump's election, this rise in all of it just made me go like, oh, so there's a whole like subsect of this country that's been biting its tongue for 40 or 50 years and is now just like eager to start, you know, hailing Hitler again. It's very interesting to me. I don't really know where it comes from. Like there's ignorance and then there's just like generational bias that is just sort of fascinating.
Well, also one thing that I thought this movie got so wrong is like the, for the first two thirds, the most interesting character is Matt Damon, who's like a rich kid who like his brother is like a big football star. And he's like, I'm never going to measure up. I'm not that smart. But like my parents have all these expectations of me. And it's like kind of interesting. And then the minute he finds out that Brendan Fraser is Jewish, he just becomes this like snarling anti-Semite, like yelling slurs.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, but like that's the kind of anti-Semitism and prejudice that almost everyone nominally can say is bad. Right. Mm-hmm. Even like racists will be like, oh, it's bad to use the N-word. Right.
Yeah.
That's like the easy kind of prejudice. And so it's like it's like it didn't say anything interesting about how this played out. And the writing, it's like, because, you know, I guess it was Dick Wolf who wrote it or did the story or whatever. It has this
fascinating,
like this weird like one dimensionality where it's like it doesn't seem like he like knows all that much about the period. It's like he's reconstructing it from like other 50s movies that he's watched. And like,
well, this did happen to him. This is somewhat autobiographical. Weird.
Wait, really? Right? I didn't come across that. Okay.
To some
degree, Dick Wolf's The Fablemans.
This is Dick Wolf's Fablemans. No, I mean, I think that to some degree this is pulled from, but I mean, to your point, Michael, like this feels so whitewashed by a studio as well. Like it doesn't feel as though it's really insightful or digging into any of this.
Right.
But yeah.
Well, I was thinking the only thing that would have made this movie kind of have a reason to exist, because the whole movie, I was like, why are we making this movie? Basically like anti-Semitism is bad is like the moral of it, which like, I don't know that like super duper like needs to have a whole movie built around it in 1992. But it's like, if it was like explicitly biographical, I think you could get like more nuance out of it. And if it was trying to be a parallel, like I was watching this with another gay male friend of mine, and we were thinking of like, if they were doing this movie about like how homophobia works in schools, And like, we're really going to draw the parallel. Like, look how bad anti-Semitism is. There's this other form of prejudice that is around now. And like, we might be making the same mistakes. That would have been kind of interesting. I mean, it also probably would have been clunky, but it's like that at least would have given this movie a reason to exist. But it's like the movie now is just like this made up story about like this extremely likable, like Mary Sue Jewish guy and how everyone is terrible to him, like openly terrible to him for being Jewish. And it's just like, yeah, that's really bad.
It feels like an after school special is ultimately what.
Yeah, it really does. That's a good way to put it.
It just doesn't have anything particularly deep to say, and it's really just. I mean, and I would also say like this movie doesn't make a lot of money either, right? Like this movie is sort of, you have to ask yourself, like, it didn't have a big budget either. It made $14 million on an $18 million budget. Like that's not really much of. It's kind of a wash, but it's still like $18 million in 1992 was not nothing. But you do have to ask yourself, like, how did this, who wanted this movie to get made?
Yeah.
Which is just kind of fascinating. I don't know the answer to that. But
yeah. Do you think Dick Wolf thinks that teenage Dick Wolf looked like Brendan Fraser? Because I actually, I have to disagree with that.
Well, the Brendan Fraser thing is interesting to unpack for a second too, because it's like, in 92, he has two films. He has this and he has Encino Man, which we have covered. I would argue he's better in Encino Man.
He has a character to play in Encino Man, as weird as that sounds.
He's not that good in this movie. It's weird. A lot, like, I like him.
I do,
but
too.
He doesn't
he's
bring
watchable.
It. Yeah.
I mean, like, he's a watchable. He's, as is the case with movie stars, right, where you're just like, I will watch this person. And he does have a star quality to him, but the role is, you feel the weight a little bit of him just being like, I know this is important.
Yeah.
And I know that I should be doing something with this, but there's just not much for me to do. But it is interesting. I mean, we'll talk the cast of this in terms of the bench of this cast, Chris O'Donnell, Matt Damon, Cole Hauser, Ben Affleck, Anthony Rapp. I mean, it's a pretty crazy bench of young actors.
Yeah, it's wild. Yeah. It also has my favorite trope about high school movies, especially from the 90s, is obviously all the actors that they cast are like 25, 28, right? Like they want to get sort of adults, right? But then all of the extras they're pulling are actual high school kids. Yep. But it creates this weird visual dissonance where it's these like obvious adults with like receding hairlines and like normal adult shit. And then in the background, there's just like visibly 15-year-olds. And you're like, this is what 15-year-olds look like.
Wait,
and like, this incredible. Is what 28-year-olds look like.
Did you not go to high schools where there were like people who seemed suspiciously older than you having more interesting problems than you all the time?
Well, the scene that that I would argue maybe the most kind of glaring to me is the shower scene, where they have like this fight, which I mean is the only other one I can think of is Eastern Promises in terms of the a naked shower fight. But like, as you said, these are all fully grown 20-something men with like, you know, cut bot, like these are good looking guys,
adult
and they're
bodies.
Men, they're dope bodies, and you're just like, these aren't fucking teenagers, like in what world could this possibly be teenagers?
A lot of 16-year-olds like aren't shaving yet, like if people are at different like developmental stages
totally.
At this time,
and Brendan Fraser looks like considerably older than everyone around him, right?
Because he's
a tall guy.
He's 24 when this is filmed, but he looks probably 28 or something. Yeah. And the whole movie, I mean, at least he kind of matches the look of the other. It's like, okay, these people are all in their late 20s, fine. But yeah, I also, like other gay men on the internet, I've seen GIFs of the shower scene from school.
This is
the only other thing. And then I realized that like GIFs are the perfect way to watch this scene because the actual scene is just like Matt Damon yelling slurs at Brendan Fraser. It's ultimately like a really ugly scene, but like
it's
in
a
my
really
head.
Ugly scene.
Because I knew literally nothing about this movie. I didn't know if it was a comedy or a drama or a horror movie. I knew nothing going in. And all I know is that like a couple little glimpses from the shower scene. And then I'm like, oh, the context of the shower scene makes the GIFs like a lot less fun.
A lot less sexy, I'd say.
Yeah, a lot. It's not really doing it for me anymore.
I did want to sort of talk about like the Matt Damon arc in terms of the fact that like he, even with this substantive role, like he's in this movie for, you know, this is a big role.
Yeah.
He kind of doesn't really do, I mean, Courage Under Fire is in 96. So that's like 4 years later. He's kind of still in the wilderness, which I think is kind of interesting.
That's actually really weird. Yeah. For somebody so conventionally attractive too at that age.
Right.
You think they just like suck him up and put him in everything.
You would think. And it's really Courage Under Fire, where he plays this soldier who's sort of a PTSD, and he notoriously lost all this weight, and he's very good in that movie. And still, like, truthfully, like, Rainmaker, Good Will Hunting is in 97. So like, it's still not easy in terms of his trajectory, which is a little fascinating. To your point, I think he would have just popped. But
what I think is fascinating is the actor who gets the biggest boost out of this movie is Chris O'Donnell, who's barely in this movie. Like, he's in it, obviously, but he doesn't really have a lot to do. And
he's the nice.
He's of the actors. He's, you know, he's certainly a fine enough actor, but he's not Matt Damon. He's not Brendan Fraser. He doesn't have that star quality. It's so weird. It's so weird.
It's,
did you guys forget that he existed? When I saw his name in the thing, I was like, oh, Chris O'Donnell. Because I haven't seen him in anything since Batman and Robin.
Michael, you don't watch NCIS LA every week?
You ever watch the 14 seasons of NCIS Los Angeles?
He's on, okay, I was, you guys are going to think I'm lying, but during the movie, I was like, he seems like someone who would be on like some weird CBS show now that you've never heard of, but like is like the third highest rated show on TV.
You got it.
I was like, he seems like he would be in that particular wilderness at this point.
It is interesting because he's in Scent of a Woman later this year as well. And, so he plays the kid in that. But to your point, Emily, I'm sort of like, you could have put Matt Damon in that role too.
Yeah.
Sure.
When I was running the AV Club TV section, I had to sort of keep abreast of everything on television. And NCIS LA, there's a lot of weird fanfic written about LL Cool J and Chris O'Donnell. Not weird. And, you know,
LL Cool J is another person I have not thought about in like 10 years.
NCIS LA is where people go for Michael to forget about them. Like, that's.
And make boatloads of money on syndication.
They're doing so well. They're all so rich.
They're so rich. I mean, it's interesting because Chris O'Donnell, we talked about this a little bit on our Scent of a Woman episode, but Chris O'Donnell kind of pops off of obviously the Batman movies, right? And then he kind of disappears. And then his resurgence is his arc on Grey's Anatomy, where he plays the hunky veterinarian that she falls in love with.
Okay.
And that's when everyone's like, oh, Chris O'Donnell, where have you been? And then he gets 15 years on. You
know, I will say teenage Emily, if the boys of this movie, teenage Emily, the one she thought was cute was Chris O'Donnell. I don't know why that was.
That's interesting.
But like, I thought that he was just such an interesting, like a man that's sort of like a wall. I don't know. That's what I wanted. I guess
not Ben Affleck, the only one who gets shirtless, it seems.
No, you know, well, I hadn't seen this movie, so maybe it would have changed if I had. But like, like looking at them now, I'm like, Brendan Fraser is so much more your type as an adult. But like at the time, I was just like, I think because Chris O'Donnell was so non-threatening, and like I was, you know, kind of scared.
Sweet. Yeah,
I was kind of scared of my queerness, and I was like, Chris O'Donnell, if he rejected me when I tried to kiss him, he would just be like, there, it's okay, you're fine.
Yeah,
just pat me on the head.
Adult Mike had a huge crush on like the troubled guy who like fails the French test, but that's more about his personality than his looks. I'm like, oh, he's sad. that's all it takes for me.
This is the thing, you know, that sort of taps into something else. As I was watching this, when I was like, I don't care if this kid does well in fucking French.
Yeah,
I don't care if this kid gets into fucking Princeton because his dad got into Princeton. Like, this is such a stakeless movie. Is the problem?
Yeah, it's
too
hard.
Like,
I know.
I don't give a fuck about these people. They're all, first of all, they all hate Jews. So like, immediately, I'm just like, I really don't care what happens to you people. But then it's also just like, I'm supposed to feel sorry for your rich white people problems? Like, it's just really.
It's really hard to get invested in this movie. Only reason I had to watch this with a friend, because I have a second screening problem, like compulsively checking my phone during movies, and then I like basically check out of them.
Sure.
So like the only way I can get like through a movie now is to have a friend there who will keep me off my phone. And if my friend was not there, I would have 100%. I would have been phoning hard
for
minute 10.
we had to reschedule this recording for a variety of reasons. And like, I watched this movie over a week ago, and I woke up this morning and was like, do I remember school time?
Oh my God, that was my thing this morning too.
Same thing. I was like, I'm glad I have my notes. I'm glad I have this in front of me, because otherwise I probably wouldn't remember a lot about it. But I do want to give just a little bit of a synopsis for our listeners who might not have seen School Ties. When David Green, played by Brendan Fraser, receives a football scholarship to a prestigious prep school in the 1950s. He feels pressure to hide the fact that he's Jewish from his classmates and teachers, fearing they may be anti-Semitic. He quickly becomes the big man on campus thanks to his football skills, but when his Jewish background is discovered, his worst fears are realized and his friends turn on him with violent threats and public ridicule. School ties opened on September 18th, 1992 against Sneakers, Captain Ron, Singles, Husbands and Wives, and The Mighty Ducks.
Sneakers, by far the best movie from the 90s. I'm saying it. Ranked one for me.
I've never seen it. And everybody who comes on is like, Sneakers fucking rules.
You cannot believe. You cannot like fathom how good that movie is. It aged really well, too.
It aged so well. Just a stellar cast, a deep bench of great actors. And also like, weirdly prescient about
what we live in. It's got like an online dating joke that's like a major plot point. It's like an online dating thing. It's good.
It's fantastic. School Ties has 60% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 69% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 3 out of 4 stars, which is insane. School Ties is surprisingly effective. The movie opens with a hometown scene that I found cartoonish as David fights the leaders of a motorcycle gang, but then becomes perceptive and unforgiving. It is not simply honest about anti-Semitism, but about the way that bigotry can do harm by inspiring dishonesty.
Bigotry's bad, you guys. Bigotry's bad. Breaking news.
Bigotry's bad, but also bigotry. Do you think that the third act of this movie is all about don't cheat and cheating's bad.
Stop cheating.
But then it also sort of becomes its own 12 Angry Men.
The end of this movie is so fucking weird. Structurally, it's like let's spend the crescendo of this movie with 5 characters who we don't know and haven't like had any personality before this point, and then like one of them is just like a huge rabid anti-Semite, and then another one like is kind of secretly like good and doesn't tell them this extremely obvious and like important piece of information for no reason. He's like, I know who cheats, but I'm just gonna not tell anyone that for no, like, as an 18-year-old this makes no sense. But it's like that whole sequence where they're like debating, like, did the Jew cheat or the non-Jew cheat? Yeah. I'm just like, who are these people? Why am I watching these people? And like the protagonist and antagonist of the film are literally sitting outside and just like staring at each other meaningfully for like 15 hours or something. It doesn't really get into like, did they have lunch?
It's shocking.
Like, what's going on?
That's the point when a little homoeroticism would have saved the movie. If they were if they were just like so overcome with desire for each other, but then also like it's the 50s, they can't act on it.
I have a thought.
Perfect.
Yeah, please.
You guys are going to think that I'm just like selfishly saying this because I'm a gay man, but I do think that like some sort of fight or like wrestling or something at the end between the protagonist or the antagonist would have made thematic sense. Like they finally like duke it out and fight, and then like everyone kind of has to pick sides. Yeah. But the 12 Angry Men thing is, it's just bizarre that like there's this 15-minute sequence of these characters we don't know debating.
We were talking about submarine movies earlier, and I love submarine movies, and I think it's because submarine movies inherently have homoerotic subtext because they're all trapped together, they're all sweaty, and they're all just like staring at each other. And this boarding school movie always has the out of, well, we know some girls from another school and we can go like hang out with them. And
I also think that there, and again, I don't know that this is a good idea, but it's better than what we got, I think. Football is part of this fucking movie. Like, just, you could have conceivably had the big game be your goddamn climax, and it would have been more interesting than what you've got. It's, you know, it's interesting. Or even, like, you know, Matt Damon gets the quarterback slot because they all hate the Jew or whatever, and he's failing, so the Jew has to come in and save the day. Whatever it is, like, there's so many ways in order to make this climax so much more interesting. But Emily, and I think this might be one of the things you don't like about boarding school movies, which is totally valid, which is they seem to get bogged down in the bureaucracy of a boarding school.
Yes.
No one fucking cares.
This is the cinematic equivalent of one of those articles that is, I hate so much, that is like, somebody said a mean thing at Yale. And I'm like, I don't fucking care. Even if it's a thing I disagree with, I fundamentally do not care if someone says a mean thing at Yale. I've never been there and I hope to never go.
Right, or all the consternation about like, this person did this thing and they might not get into Yale. It's like, okay, they have to go to University of Pennsylvania or something. I don't have a lot of sympathy for these people. Sorry.
And they all seem to fall back on like, these old rules that existed. Like back in the day when this school was built in the 1600s, we created this fucking Declaration of Independence or whatever the fuck it is, or Constitution. And we all have to go by these old rules that racists made. And I'm just like, Like, why?
No, you live in the United States of America. We do have to abide by some rules that old racists made.
That's fair. Maybe it's all just an allegory for America, guys.
My wife, who listens through the wall to this podcast, just slacked me. How do you feel about Yale, honey?
It's also the other thing about this movie is like, it's not totally predictable, but the honor code, it's such fucking Chekhov's honor code. They make such a big deal about like, this school is based on the honor code. And you're like, all right, there's going to be a climax involving where someone breaks a fucking honor code. You're like, it's just so telegraphed that like, this is what the whole thing is going to hinge on.
100%.
I want to ask you both a question, but I think Phil, because I know you mostly Phil, because I know you love the Fablemans as much as I do.
I do.
That movie has a lot of very similarly overt anti-Semitism, and that was the one reason I was sort of able to be in School Ties. Well, maybe this is like based on an actual, because Fablemans is famously based on Steven Spielberg during the quarantine, just sat down with Tony Kushner and was like, here's a bunch of weird shit that happened to me. Tony Kushner was like, you sure you don't want to look at that closer? And he's like, no, I'm just going to make a movie.
Want to go to therapy? No, I'm good. No, let's just make a movie.
No, not going to therapy. Now my wife has sent me Steven Spielberg is to the U of California schools as Emily St. James is to Yale.
That should be your Twitter bio.
That movie has similarly high school characters confronting anti-Semitism. These guys being overtly like, you killed Jesus, to young Steven Spielberg stand-in. And like, it didn't bug me in the way this movie did. And I'm like wondering if that's because I knew it was a true story. Or I honestly, I think it's because they're visibly teenagers, and like, you buy teenagers saying edgy bullshit because they've watched too much South Park or whatever in a way that you don't like someone who's 24. You're like, you should have figured this out by now.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it's I think ultimately, first of all, the Fablemans, I would say, too, like, it does deal with anti-Semitism, but it's like not about anti-Semitism, right? Like it's not like that is not its modus operandi.
Yeah.
This movie is just like, that's really all it has to say.
Yeah.
And I would, you know, the way that, I mean, I think that Spielberg handles it relatively deftly in the back half of the Fablemans. But it also seems to be kind of baked into this romance that exists as well.
Yeah. And the romance is more important to the story ultimately.
Right. Yeah. And that he's, and he knows that people are going to be more invested in that ultimately than they're going to be in the anti-Semitism, which is actually an interesting segue to the romance that exists in this film, which I would argue I liked fine. I thought it was certainly a breath of fresh air from all the other shit that was going on in this film. There were little details that I like. The balloons in between the kids at the dance so that they couldn't get too close to each other, I thought was like a nice detail.
Yeah, that was one of the only things that kind of felt true and kind of interesting. But there's a couple little things peek through where you're like, oh, there's like maybe an interesting movie that could have been made about this.
No, totally. I have to say too, like the Sally character who's played by this actress, Amy Locane, I believe is
the only person not to get famous from this movie, by the way.
Well, did you read her whole story?
No.
So I wanted to kind of talk about this because I think it's interesting. So I guess in 2010, she was in a DUI car crash that resulted in the death of a person.
Oh God.
Which is, her blood alcohol level was 0.23%. Like,
holy shit.
Bad, no good. And a tragic story. So she's indicted on aggravated manslaughter. And then she's convicted of vehicular homicide in 2012, 2013. She's sentenced to 3 years in prison for the crime.
No way.
It is what it is, right? So she serves. So basically what happens in 2013, she's sentenced to 3 years in prison, the judge imposing less than the minimum 5-year sentence due to mitigating factors that he felt was part of her child's welfare, what have you, right? So she's sentenced, she serves it. But then in 2016, it's ruled that the sentence was too lenient and she is then tried again for this.
Oh, wow.
For all of this, it's ruled that she in 2017, it's ruled that she should do an additional 6 months and then she shouldn't have to go back to prison or whatever the case might be. But then in 2019, she's resentenced to 5 years behind bars and she has to go back to prison. And this is, and then in 2020, she's sentenced to 8 years. Like it all, like it's one of these crazy situations where the legal system just keeps like,
do you think there's the prison industrial complex is broken? Do you think there's like some problems with it?
There is, but it was, I was reading this on her Wikipedia page as I was watching the film and just being like, because I thought to myself, like, how come she didn't have a career?
Yeah.
She's in Crybaby. She's in John Waters' Crybaby. She's in a few films and she's good in this movie. And then she's in like a couple other things and then like disappears. And I was like, how come? And I was like, oh, the justice system apparently course, was like,
I didn't know the justice system could like extend your sentence, like renewing a Twitch sub.
I thought it was like, just a like,
okay, here's another 6 months. Yeah.
And of course, I'm like, wow, the justice system's broken when it affects an attractive white woman. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, that's, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was like, someone needs to talk about the attractive white women. Finally.
But it is a fascinating situation. But this is all a long way of saying that I did think she was good in this movie.
Yeah.
And I do think that like there's this interesting thing where David.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I guess so. So Matt Damon's character has decided that Sally is his quote unquote, his girl, right? Even though it seems as though she's sort of on the fence about like how really sort of, you know, into him.
That also actually felt real and kind of interesting to me of like how his relationship with her is mostly to impress his friends.
Right.
And he's not.
And
he's
ownership
like,
quality.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's like a status seeking among men, not necessarily interested in her. Yeah.
When this movie is kind of more about the assumptions WASPs make about the world versus Brendan Fraser, not just as a Jewish person, but as a person from a lower class background, from a working class town, the assumptions he makes about the world, like there's something there that you then could bake the anti-Semitism and the classism into in a way that would like make this movie effective. But yeah, the movie just doesn't care to do that because it is ultimately beholden to the WASPs' point of view of the world.
Right.
Absolutely. And it oddly stumbles upon something interesting and then kind of just sort of discards it. But I what I thought was interesting is David goes up to Sally and like just kind of says how pretty she thinks she is, which I found like surprisingly like honest and forthright. Like in situations like that, especially at that time in your life, I feel like you don't have the confidence to do something like that, which I did think kind of made his character pop for a second where I was like, look at this guy, he's actually like wants to, you know, speak his mind. And I think that sort of was an interesting thing. Unfortunately, their relationship falls into the whole like, you lied to me by not telling me that you're Jewish, and had I known you were Jewish, I would never have dated you thing.
It's so boring. It's like, and then her whole point is like, you lied to me about being Jewish. But then she doesn't seem to like acknowledge the fact that there's a very good reason why he would do that. That like everyone is hella anti-Semitic in this movie. So it's like, yeah, of course a guy lied about being part of a group that everyone just openly fucking hates. But then she's just like, you lied.
Yeah. And by the way, he never did. He just wasn't forthright about that information. Not to get into a semantic.
Yeah, but that was also some libertarian. But that was him being a little libertarian. He's like, I never technically lied. I never said it. It's like, it's no, little, I mean.
Fair enough.
This being a Dick Wolf program, he should have brought in Sam Waterston to be like, now, are you sure that counts as a lie.
Oh, God. Sam Waterston. I've been watching The Newsroom and Sam Waterston in that
show. Why are you watching The Newsroom still?
Oh, Phil. That's a whole podcast. You guys could do a whole every episode of The Newsroom. Just melt down about how like sanctimonious it is. That would be
it's,
great.
I mean, I'm not writing for The Newsroom, just saying. I did think that she was, I thought she was interesting. I think that like Sally, when she breaks up with her and is like, but all my friends are saying that it's like, it all of this seems to be the same shit, which is that when you're in high school, we're all fucking like, you know, lemmings and we all don't want to like, you know, ruin our friendships. So we all kind of say the same. I'm just like, really, like, as does it go as far as anti-Semitism that you're like that much of a lemming? But I guess back in the day,
but see, again, maybe that would be kind of more interesting. I also think this is the problem with like 90% of movies that feature romances is that we never actually get a reason why these people like each other other than thinking that each other are hot. And so it's like you don't really if they had a connection that transcended all this stuff, then you could sort of like see it as this tragic thing, or like, I really am in love with you, but my parents are anti-Semitic and I can't see you anymore. Like, you could have a sort of a layered depiction, but it's like, she just kind of thinks you're hot and you think she's hot and there's lots of hot people in the world. So it's hard to sort of see this as like a grand tragedy. Like, I had no emotional investment in this because she's just going to find some other hot.
And they're just hormonal fucking teenagers on top of anything else. Or it's like, anyway.
That's where the homophobia parallel could have helped this movie. You know, it probably still would have been clunky, but being like, and in 1992, it's much easier to imagine everybody in the school, you know, calling you slurs because you're gay.
Yeah.
You know, than it is, you know, at that time to imagine the sort of rolling ball of anti-Semitism. So like, I think, I'm just mad that as queer people, we didn't get far enough along in the acceptance by society to have our school ties. That's like set in the 90s. And everyone is like, you know, and we're like, well, we've come so far since then. Instead, we were like, we've come so far since then. Better immediately start pulling that back. Thanks.
The only way we're going to get that movie now is if there's a superhero or like a Mattel toy in it somehow. We need the IP tie.
That is grim.
They have been trying to make the Stretch Armstrong movie for a long time. What if Stretch Armstrong is the school ties of queer phobia? What if we just do that?
I do think it's worth I want to talk about Ben Affleck for a quick second, who is in this film, doesn't really have much of a role. I think he's got like maybe 5 or 6 lines, but he's in it, and I think it's probably the first time that people like saw him because the next movie is Dazed and Confused in 93 when he
he's good in,
he's very good in and looks totally different.
That's funny. I keep forgetting he's in that movie because he doesn't seem very Ben Afflecky.
Right. He plays this asshole. He plays O'Banion, who's just like this kid who wants to beat the shit out of younger kids and whatever. And he's great, but he seems like an adult in Dazed and Confused, which is only a year later. Like, he has a crazy growth spurt and like turns into a much bigger person. And then it's Mallrats, and then it's Chasing Amy in 97 and Good Will Hunting in 97. And then, you know, off to the races.
Bring me back for the Chasing Amy episode, by the way. Ooh,
right? That movie,
that's gonna be a long one.
Does not age well.
Rich text.
Don't you think it's interesting though how Chasing Amy for the longest time, and might still be for the record, the movie that everyone was like, that's Kevin Smith's good one.
That's at least his interesting one. Like, you could still watch that and dissect it in a way.
Is interesting.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's interesting in that it's like his own weird psychodrama stuff.
Yeah,
and like it's really him dealing with his own shit. It's like a New York Times op-ed. Like, there's like you really processing some shit and turning it into something that you're showing to other people.
And there speaking is of the op-ed component, his characters just go on these diatribes, which is sort of his thing. But like, rants. It's so this is just about being gay. Yeah.
There's a really fascinating recent documentary that I sadly can't remember. I think it's called Chasing Amy. It's the director. The director basically, while making it, I don't know their pronouns offhand, so I'm going to use generic ones. They confront their gender identity because they're like, I love Chasing Amy so much, and I related to the Ben Affleck character. What does that? And it's just like this. And they interviewed Kevin Smith. They interviewed a bunch of people from. It's a fascinating documentary, and that people should check out. I think it's.
I think first of all, I will check that out, and I think that the reason that Chasing Amy has sort of continues to be the one that everyone's like, well, he's really kind of, you know, investigating some stuff because like there is ideas in it, right?
Yeah,
it's like the idea that like even just like the end of the whole threesome thing at the end, where he's like, this is the best way for me to deal with my love for both of you is for us to all have a threesome, is like such a rudimentary idea of.
I forgot that that's Kevin Smith's E2 Mama Tambien. Like, I forgot that.
It is, though. It's so crazy. Like, that movie's, oh my God. It's
amazing. It is. I mean, that actually kind of self-aware about, like, the way that, like, straight dudes deal with this shit in, like, the most cringe and clunky way possible. But it's not clear to me that Kevin Smith knows that.
Not at all. Certainly not in 97.
I do kind of want to talk about modern day Ben Affleck, because I think he's such a weird, compelling figure in our pop culture. Yeah. My favorite movie review of all time is My Personal Trainer. My Personal Trainer sees everything, is totally not online, so he sees no discourse. He's like a real, he's got a smart film take, but I never know what he's going to say. He saw The Last Duel, and his review of it was pretty good movie. Boy, that Ben Affleck, I don't know what I think about him. And I was like, Ben Affleck has been around for 30 years at this point. Yeah. Like, to not have a take on him is wild.
And also, he's great in The Last Duel. He's maybe great the best in thing it. In the
it's, yeah. It's just like him being like, I'm not sure how I feel about, but I feel like I, at the same time, that taps into something where I feel like none of us is entirely sure how we feel about Ben Affleck at any given time.
It is? Yeah.
His career is fascinating in a bunch of ways, in the sense that he's had a bunch of get out of jail free cards, right? Where it's like, where his career has just absolutely, you know, just bottomed out, or everyone's just like, I'm done with this guy. And then he just gets another go and he gets another chance. And there's also the whole, like, and this fits into the Matt Damon thing too, which is Boston Bros, man.
Yeah.
Like, there's something there too, where like both these guys, cause like, I'm sure we all remember the Project Greenlight fiasco with Matt Damon when he stepped in it with all that stuff. And I somehow these guys just navigate these landmines and find ways to just back into our hearts, back into America's heart. It's amazing.
Boston is another thing I don't care about. Go ahead, Michael. Yeah,
sure. I think there's, I think that maybe the only celebrity, like resilient celebrity, who has been in more bad movies than Ben Affleck is Angelina Jolie, who to my knowledge has never been in a good movie, but remains like a huge celebrity. And I feel like so much of it, this is maybe, I mean, I don't have her filmography in front of me, but it's like, yeah, she's in like almost exclusively like deeply mediocre movies.
She is. I'm pulling it up just, yeah.
I think the sort of quote unquote, like, I know this was not his choice, but like the savvy thing that happened to his career was he became like a paparazzi figure. And I think the fact that he was in fucking Us Weekly every week solidifies him in your head as like, this is a celebrity. Like this person doesn't lose their celebrity status just by not doing the thing that celebrities are supposed to do, which is like being in good movies. And like, I think that's a big part of his resiliency. And also the fact that he seems to be like a genuinely very good like writer and director. He just cannot pick movies to act in to save his life.
He's bad at picking performances.
Yeah.
I do think just to piggyback on what you were saying in terms of the celebrity of it all, he also dated a lot of celebrities, right?
Yeah.
Like he had, and whereas something, which is something that Matt Damon didn't really do.
Right.
Matt Damon didn't want to be on the cover of People magazine, it seemed, or be in various tabloids, whereas Ben Affleck, it seemed he did want that.
Matt Damon just married some lady he fell in love with like a chump, and they're still together.
This is true. It's true. But I just, it's like, it's the Gwyneth Paltrow thing. It's, you know, it's then the Jennifer Lopez, then Jennifer Garner. Like it's just, there's all these things. And also obviously his struggles, it seems, with various vices.
But that is really true. Like every time I think I'm kind of done with Ben Affleck, there's like a thing where they photograph him standing on the beach, staring mournfully into the distance. Yeah. And I'm like, I still love this guy.
And you just juggling Dunkin' Donuts coffees.
And you just say the word same out loud. Any paparazzi photo of Ben Affleck. But also, like, The Town is, like, honestly one of my favorite movies. Yep. Like, that's a great movie. It's really smartly written. It's really smartly directed. Like, that movie whips ass, and he's great in that movie.
I mean, Gone Baby Gone is a well-directed
movie. Yeah, Gone Baby Gone is really good.
He's a good director. He is an intelligent person.
Yeah.
You know, I don't love when people go on Bill Maher. I'm not a fan of Bill Maher, but oh, I do feel like Ben Affleck's the type of guy who goes on there and goes toe to toe with him, yeah, in a sense that, like, you know, you actually get the impression that he has a brain. But it's just, he's, the funny thing is, I learned recently, like this week, that he was actually the second choice for Gone Girl, which I find shocking because it feels like that's a role that Ben Affleck
was first.
John Hamm.
Oh. Okay.
I believe my understanding is that when Reese Witherspoon optioned the book, she wanted to star in it. And they were like, we can't have two huge stars in those two roles because that kind of breaks the movie. So it's going to be Reese and John Hamm. And then David Fincher's talks Reese out of doing it. And they get Rosamund Pike and they're like, well, now we need a bigger star as the guy. And that is like my favorite Ben Affleck performance. He's so good in that.
He's incredible in that film. And that makes absolute sense what you're saying, Emily, because I know that Reese bought the book rights and was the one that like was producing it and wanted to be in it. And she's all wrong for aiming.
To be clear, this is just rumors I've heard. I don't know that these are true, but I have heard the rumors.
But that makes sense. So. But the John Hamm thing in the Reese and John Hamm is all wrong. That movie, I'm not sure, makes a ton of sense. The John Hamm, Rosamund Pike would have been interesting too, for what it's worth. This is all just a long way of saying that I think that Ben Affleck has gone through so many iterations of himself, it seems like, and Gone Girl felt like a moment when he like tapped into who he is in a real way and how people perceive him and how so much of what you guys are both talking about in terms of how his stardom is part of it, right? Like it is part of what people love about it.
I also deeply relate to somebody who can convincingly be unlikable but struggles to be likable. I think there's other actors, I think, like maybe Tom Cruise being the most like the pinnacle example of like he can play a dick and someone who you dislike, like Edge of Tomorrow Tom Cruise, you're like, yeah, this guy sucks. Yeah. And like he is like Oscar worthy playing like kind of a smug dick. But anytime he tries to be an everyman, you're just like, nah, man, this is not. I think he realized that at a certain point. It's like, I'm just going to play smug dicks from now on.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only time that he found a balance might be Jerry Maguire. I think that Cameron Crowe in that moment sort of understood that there was a way to make him a little bit everyman, but also acknowledge the fact that he is some.
He's also not really everyman in that movie. He's like, he's kind of a too good to be true. Though. Yeah, well,
he has to be at least 8% sociopath for him to work in any movie.
Yeah,
every character needs that.
I think honestly, I think it's that Renee Zellweger is in it, and she's kind of keeping him tethered to the planet in a weird way.
Yeah, she's so good.
So I want to circle back very quickly to the Angelina Jolie thing here because I am looking at her filmography.
Okay, sorry, you're...
because I think it's worth. I'm actually going to agree with you. Is my point because I'm looking at her filmography, and to your point, it is a bunch of weird movies, movies that either don't really hit. She is a movie star, so people go and see Beyond Borders and Taking Lives, I guess. Like, so she wins an Oscar for Girl Interrupted. We've talked about this on our 99 podcast, undeservedly. I think she's good in that movie, but that nomination is crazy in terms of, like, she's up against Catherine Keener and Being John Malkovich. Like, she's up against people that should have, like, literally won the Oscar before her, but she wins it because she's fucking Hollywood quote-unquote royalty, I guess. Gone in 60 Seconds, Lara Croft. Like, it's a bunch of weird shit. I'll say the movie that
mediocre stuff. They're not bad, but they're not that good or that memorable. Like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which I saw in the theater and then immediately forgot about. It's like,
I think that's a fun movie. That might be my favorite movie of hers, if I'm being completely honest. And that says something.
That's bleak. That's bleak.
Honestly, her best movie is one right at the start of her career. She does Gia on HBO. And that's a TV movie, and she's good. And it's just, it's also like everyone was like, look at this exciting new star. And then it kind of just becomes, she's just in movies that are like, Angelina Jolie is sure hot. And I'm like, I agreed, but I'm not sure what. Yeah.
That is really a lot of it. I mean, part of it is that she is a very attractive, very sort of like, but then there's also like, it's weird because she was so bankable for a time there.
Yeah.
Where literally she could do anything.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Salt is fine. I don't think it's a great movie, but like that movie made a lot of money because she was in it.
Because she's in it.
What's the one where like they bend bullets and stuff?
Wanted.
I kind of like that one. Yeah. That one's so dumb. I kind of like it.
It's real dumb.
Yeah.
And it's something about like they're weavers. They weave like a thing of time. I'm like, what the fuck is this movie? Anyway, that movie's insane. But go ahead.
Please.
No, please. Please go ahead.
Before we wrap, because I don't know what else there is to say about this movie, I do want to talk about how this does seem like it was Oscar bait. It does seem like this movie was aiming.
Oh yeah.
The director of this movie, his name is Robert Mandel. Yes. He's a guy who does a bunch of stuff in the 80s where it's clear that they're like, this is one of our next great directors. They keep handing him these movies that have, like, on paper, like, Oscar worthy, interesting premises. He also he does a lot of movies about race relations in the 80s, which is so strange. He breaks through with this little indie movie called Independence Day at a time when indie movies aren't really that common. And, like, I've never seen it, but it sounds like the kind of interesting movie that someone would make at that time. And then he does a bunch of movies that are like two kind of mismatched people, but there's like an element. And then this is, it's not only him, but like all the below the line cat people are like, this is who you'd put on an Oscar movie in 1992. The score is by Maurice Jarre, who wrote the scores he wrote the scores for Lawrence of Arabia and like all of David Lean's films. This movie flops. The next thing Robert Mandel directs, and I have my Fox Mulder action figure right here, is the X-Files pilot. They're like, Fox saw School Ties and was like, you know who we should have direct our alien pilot? The guy who did School Ties. And he does a couple other movies, but he mostly
I have no idea.
And that's a great pilot. That is a like great atmospheric pilot with some amazing like shot choices. It really sets up the weird, eerie horror. And I'm like, Robert Mandel, should you have just been making TV shows about aliens all along? Was that like your
Did he do after? Did he do any other pilots?
He did some other movies. I'm not touching my computer lest it shut down again.
But okay.
He's on NCIS Houston. Now, I don't know if you guys know it.
Oh wow,
it's like the fourth most popular.
I am looking up his. So okay, he did the pilot of the X-Files, as you mentioned. He did episodes of just six episodes of Nash Bridges. He did an episode of The Practice, and he made a movie called The Substitute in '96. Remember the Tom Berenger?
He keeps making these movies that feel like they're going to be important and then just aren't.
This movie does have like TV pilot written all over it. The only like action scenes or whatever are the football scenes, and they're terribly directed. It's like handheld shaky cam. It's like all of a sudden I'm in like a Doug Liman movie. Like, okay, but it's totally fucking incoherent. And then we get back to the talking scenes, which is 90% of the movie, and it's just like, shoulder to shoulder over the whatever. Like, he's not doing anything visually interesting with this. It feels like they just like quickie directed it.
I agree. I also feel like what I kind of wish I had more of was like real camaraderie between these guys.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't say what you will about Dead Poets Society. Like, I do think that Peter Weir created a situation where like all these guys kind of pop in different ways and they all feel like they're friends, and it would have gone so far in terms of selling me on the slow burn, which is fucking slow. Like, we do not get the anti-Semitism until like an hour into this movie.
Yeah,
the movie's like an hour 40 minutes.
Yeah, it's
so like it's it goes on. The inciting
incident
time.
Is like two-thirds of the way into the movie. Like,
listen, okay, so we're gonna argue about Tar.
For the last two
we're argue about Tar, a great American film of our time.
Emily, I hated it so much.
I know you did. I know you did.
I watched it with the same friend that I watched this with, and we were both just like struck, like stricken, watching the screen. Like, is anything going to happen at any
point? That is amazing. I mean, I love Tar, as Emily obviously loves Tar, but I do think that my point more than anything was, had they built in an element of camaraderie with these guys, and I felt like I had an investment in their friendship, when it was then revealed to me that they're all anti-Semitic assholes, it would have been a little bit more of a gut punch. Whereas with this, I'm just like, I don't care about these kids.
But the thing about Dead Poets Society that makes it work, and again, it's not a movie I love, but like it works better than this, is that it's about a teacher. And the inspiring teacher movie is a subgenre that exists independently of boarding schools.
Sure.
So you can, like, there are stakes to the Robin Williams character in that movie. You know, he can lose his job. It's not huge stakes, but they are like life changing stakes. Mm-hmm. And there just aren't when you make a movie about boarding school students, because I know Matt Damon's going to be fucking fine. They're going to write about him in a newspaper and be like, he spoke up for his values and he was kicked out of school.
Yeah, I do just very briefly want to talk about Brendan Fraser for a second here. We talked about him a little bit on, obviously, on Encino Man, but it's worth talking about it just in the sense that, like, He's in two movies. Two
very handsome. He's in, very handsome.
He's a handsome guy. He's very handsome. Yeah. He's very handsome in this. Oh, okay. Yeah, maybe not. Michael's not on.
They're all kind of blandly handsome to me. Every they're all so That's interchangeable true. In this movie.
They're very bland.
Brendan Fraser becomes more handsome when they let him be goofy. In the latter right. half of the 90s, like that's when I'm like, yeah. now we're cooking with gas.
I agree. He's and that's why like Encino Man taps into that. And I Encino Man and School Ties in 92, you would think like this guy is on a trajectory, and there really isn't anything. In 94, he's in With Honors, which is an ensemble piece. Airheads is also an ensemble piece. You know, he really doesn't, he gets really stuck, and I feel for the guy. He's like Mrs. Winterbourne, is, you know what I mean, the scout. It's really grim. He's in Gods and Monsters in 98, which is a great right. movie, and he's very good in it. And that kind of gives him a little bit of juice, because in 99, Blast from the Past, The Mummy, Dudley Do-Right.
When's George of the Jungle?
Because George of the Jungle is 97. That is before
I think
Gods
that's when he, yes, I think that's kind of when he,
you're right.
Because that was when I noticed him. Because that was like that. That was like Hollywood finally being like,
I'll
"Let's
yeah."
Love that loin cloth.
That's when I noticed this gentleman. just the upper quarter. To third of this gentleman. Yes.
Because that's when Hollywood is like, why don't we do more Encino Mans with this guy? And that's when he takes off. Because like they're letting him be silly.
I absolutely agree. He does that for a bit, and then, you know, ultimately, it's The Mummy, makes a lot of money off The Mummy, Monkey Bone, which is terrible. And then he kind of disappears for a while. He appears in Crash. You know, he does
God,
a bunch.
I forgot everything about that movie. I've now blocked out of my head.
As you should. So, yeah, you should memory hole the fuck out of that movie. Yeah. And then, you know, he does another Mummy movie in 2008. Somehow, like, physically is able to do that. And he kind of just truly disappears until The Whale. Like, it's you know, which, I mean, he's in No Sudden Move. He's in that Danny
Boyle
thing.
TV, right? Yeah.
Yeah. He's in the Danny Boyle Trust, which is about the, which, you know, no one saw, but yeah.
He showed up to TCA in a big cowboy hat. And that was like one of my favorite things to ever happen. I just was like, look at this man in a cowboy hat. My queer awakening came just months later, and I'm not even kidding.
But wasn't he like sexually assaulted and like had some injuries and so he couldn't work out anymore? And so he gained weight and people were like unbelievably shitty to him about the fact that he gained weight. And then he became this weird sort of like figure of scorn. And then he's had this like now allegedly triumphant comeback, but he's in like the most fat phobic movie imaginable.
Ever made,
so it's like really hard to root for him at this point. But like, he seems like a nice guy, and I, you know, I want good things for this nice guy, but that movie is like indefensible.
Is he Oppenheimer? Is he one
he's
of
not.
The
He's in Killers of the Flower Moon.
Oh, okay. That's what I was thinking of. There's two movies that every actor is in, and that was the one.
Those are the two movies, yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you, Michael, that like, first and foremost, it should be said, yes, there was this whole sexual assault thing. There was this whole Golden Globes fiasco and all awful. And
people like kind of didn't take him seriously.
Or
also,
took his side in it either. Which is like they kind of took the Golden Globes side in this whole situation.
Which is,
And then to your point, Emily, the Mummy movies literally destroyed him physically. Like it was, he talks about how the last Mummy movie was like popsicle sticks and glue. Like he was barely fucking keeping together. And then it's, as you said, Emily, you know, there's just sort of this, everyone kind of mocks him and kind of he's put in this box. And then ultimately, I would argue it's kind of, it's a mixture of the FX show Trust. And also Soderbergh gives him a pretty meaty role in No Sudden Move, which is a good movie that kind of just got dumped during the pandemic. And then The Whale, in theory, I am all about this guy getting another chance in his career, but the movie is just impossible to root for. I can root for, but the movie is just impossible to root for.
Worst movie I saw last year. I think he's fine in it. Like I'm glad he has an Oscar. I cannot believe it's for that.
It's bleak. It's really bleak. Like rewarding this kind of movie as well, just like as a category of movie.
Totally agree.
It's also very palpable to me that all three of us are desperate to talk about anything other than School Ties.
There's not that much.
Ben Affleck, Tar, give me
whatever
anything.
It is. I mean, we've talked this about fucking School movie. Ties. I do want to just, as we wrap this up, we do a rating on this podcast, 0 to 99, 0 being the lowest, obviously 99 being the highest. I came into this podcast at a 35 for this movie. I think that's maybe even being generous, but that's kind of where I'm at. What would you give this film, Emily?
Well, the queer phobia scale, which is a 1 to 10, 1 being the least queer phobia, or like 1 being actively like queer positive and 10 being just like the most queer phobic. Basic, just to give you a sense of where it landed, Basic Instinct, a cute movie that thinks that lesbians are murderers, got an 8, but with an enthusiastic thumbs up because lesbians are murderers and it's great. I'm going to give this a 7, not because there's like overt queer phobia, but because it is literally just like, oh, these guys are just the worst and they are obviously. And also, it should have had boys kissing. There should have been some boys kissing, even just as a subplot, and they just ignore that. Actually,
or
rating
some looks of longing. I would have just had. I mean,
give me some subtext, you guys. Come on, give me something to ship with.
This is like the most. There's no homoeroticism to this movie, and it's a real problem. To actually rate the movie, I'm going to say 26. I liked a couple of the actors well enough, and Robert Mandel like occasionally knows where to put a camera during a dialogue scene, but it's not very good.
The weird thing is, I don't know that I dislike this movie. I just don't like it. Like, it's competent. Right. It's well-structured. The dialogue is fine. There's nothing so cringe that you're, like, laughing at, like, oh, this is so bad, right?
Sure.
But, like, it's just not good. It's the absence of good more than the presence of bad that really struck me of this. It's kind of quietly competent, but it's, like, why does it exist? It just is like on the scale of like essential versus inessential. It just like didn't need to exist. It didn't need to be made. I'm never going to think about it ever again after this conversation. There's nothing memorable about it. It doesn't say anything interesting. It doesn't set out to say anything interesting. It just like didn't need to exist. So I don't, on a scale of 1 to 99, it's like, does that make it a 0? Does that make it a 50? Like I really can't.
That's fair. I think
for the people who run our wiki and put down everybody's ratings, definitely a Michael score is 0 or 50.
0 to 50. I'm copping out.
I do want to get your thoughts, perhaps, Michael, on the movie we're covering next week, a movie that maybe you have seen, maybe you haven't seen. Don't know. The film is Honeymoon in Vegas with Nicolas Cage and Sarah Jessica Parker.
Honestly, okay. Nothing.
Do you have thoughts on either of them? I guess is my question.
They both seem nice. I don't know. I don't really have any. They've both been through journeys. Can I make a weird like 90s comment?
Absolutely.
One thing that really struck me. So after I watched School Ties, I was like, oh my God, I have to talk about this fucking movie. What can I say? So I went and I read a bunch of the contemporaneous reviews of it. I don't know if you guys have noticed this from doing the show and reading other reviews from the 90s. The number of fucking spoilers in the reviews, numerous reviews were like, the film crescendos on like an exam cheating scandal where everyone blames the Jewish guy. I'm like, that's a twist in the movie. That's like the last thing that happens. It's literally like 8 minutes from the end of the movie that you're spoiling in the review. Crazy. And like the word, I don't think the word spoiler existed yet. So there's not like spoiler warning.
No, it's
whatever.
This is a hobby horse of mine. I think you and I have emailed about it before, Michael, actually. Like, spoiler as a concept didn't really exist until the late 90s. Like there's an article about the movie Star Wars from the year 1976, a year before it came out, in the New York Times that spoils the entire plot of Star Wars. Nobody cared. People were like, whatever.
Yeah. Cancellation alert. This is one of the things I've really noticed in Roger Ebert's reviews.
He does it a lot. Yeah.
He does A, weird factual errors, and B, like super duper spoily plot descriptions. And it's like at the time, reviews were coming out on the same day the movie released. So 99% of people are not going to see the movie before they read the review. And it's like, it just is like really baffling to me as a choice. To just like say what happens in the last 20 minutes of the movie. I feel like movies, I mean, back when there were dramas, movies used to also spoil the movies hugely in the trailers too. Yeah. They basically give you the entire skeleton of the plot. Yeah, it's just like, it's all superhero movies now. So like, I don't even know how we're marketing these things. But like a lot of trailers, I remember seeing movies and like I would get interested in the movie when like the thing the trailer told me is over. And I remember movies being like, oh, the last like 15 minutes is new to me. But everything else,
people freak out so much about spoilers in superhero movies, and they're all the same. They all end the same way. They all, it doesn't. And literally what they just mean is they don't want to know who's cameoing, which is.
Yeah.
Can I tell my Roger Ebert story real quickly?
Please
do it.
When I started out my career, I was on the copy desk at the Press Enterprise of Riverside, California. And I was reading his reviews. They would come in over the wire every week. And so I would read all of them. And he made so many factual errors. I started emailing them to his editor. And eventually I just started emailing Roger Ebert directly because he was like really supportive of young critics and stuff. So like we became like sort of close. But the one I remember is close is a wrong word, but like he knew who I was is a way to put it. The one I remember vividly is there was some review of something with Rachel McAdams in it, and he was talking about her role in The Hot Chick, and he got it completely wrong. And so I wrote to him, and of course I was interested in a movie where somebody body swapped with a hot chick for some reason. I had seen that movie. So I wrote to Roger Ebert and was like, you got this thing wrong about The Hot Chick. And he was like, you know what, you're right, I'm glad that you've seen The Hot Chick so I didn't have to watch it again. So that's my,
I don't know why this like implanted in my brain, but I remember his review of Steven Soderbergh's Traffic, where remember like Topher Grace gives this like really didactic monologue of like the war on drugs is bad because like it's addiction when rich people do it and when poor people do it, blah, blah, blah. And in the review, he says like a black character gives a moving monologue about why the war on drugs is wrong. And I was like, do you not know who gave them all? Like, you saw this yesterday. How are you? But it's like every time I read one of his old reviews, he has these like massive factual errors, which is, I guess, the editors couldn't correct because they hadn't seen the movies because they were embargoed yet. But it's oftentimes he'll be like, oh, and then they go to Texas and you're like, they went to Tennessee. Why is this in the review?
You find this a lot in all old, because they got to see the movie one time. You know, they maybe took notes and then they immediately ran out and just wrote it up. And the editors hadn't seen it. So there was like no meaningful way to fact check them. But it's not just Ebert. It's endemic to reviews at that period.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I also wonder as well, and Emily, you can speak to this obviously more than I can. But like when you're a critic and you have to see everything, I imagine that at a certain point, you know what I mean? Very few things pop. Like the reality is that Roger Ebert in his time was still one of the premier critics, because every now and then he would, you know, hone in on 10 movies a year where he would be really articulate and
super insightful,
somewhat brilliant, insightful about that film. But then the other 99% of the films that he's reviewing, just doesn't give a shit.
He's banging them out.
He's one of the best to have ever done it. And you know, if you read if you were just randomly selected a review by him, you know, it's you're gonna read it and be like, yeah, I guess he's a better writer than a lot of people. But like, you know, if you read his review of School Ties, you're not gonna get why he was so good.
Right.
Similarly,
also, this I've wanted to do like maybe a podcast series or a podcast episode about like the lost debates of like things that people thought about. And Roger Ebert, I don't know if anybody remembers this, in the 1990s he had this weird fucking crusade that video games were not art.
He had that like, right up until his death.
It's just the weirdest fucking hill to die on. It's like such like the perfect boomer thing where it's just like pointless gatekeeping and about a genre of entertainment that you don't understand, right? He probably couldn't even name five video games. But it's just like, okay, this is just this weird stance that you're going to take. And then these poor, like, actual video game developers would try to explain to him, like, no, this is a creative field. It's just very obvious to me that it is a form of art, whatever you think about it.
He's very old white man get off my lawn about a lot of things.
Yeah.
And he's also, like, my biggest pet peeve, and I've read a lot of Roger Ebert reviews over the last 5 or 6 years as we've done this podcast and the 99 podcast, is that he's a bit of a creep. He's a bit of a creep when it comes to women.
Where
I'm just like, oh dude, like stop being such a lech. Like I just like if you read the American Beauty review, and he certainly wasn't the only person to get on the American Beauty train.
I can only imagine how badly the reviews of that age.
Because you're just like, I get it, Roger, you thought Mina Suvari was hot, but like that's not I know the movie is cheering us quote unquote on in that fucked up way, but like my god, just that to me is sort of like he got lost in those choppy waters, to say the least.
Him and Kevin Smith working through their stuff in the 1990s, just working through it. inflicting their working through itness on the rest of us.
Well, listen,
in this very public way.
Michael, if you ever want to do just a Roger things Roger Ebert was wrong about podcast, I'm there. Let's do it.
Oh my Bring god!
I'll do this
great.
In five. Let's just keep recording and go into it.
I mean, I can't wait for our Chasing Amy episode. It, you know, all 7 hours of it. It'll be great. I mean, that movie is fascinating. I'll just say that it's an interesting relic of a time. Yeah, please.
I don't know if you guys are like this, but the stuff that I was into at the time and now cringe about is the stuff that I'm like the most. Like angry and like worked up about, because I was like a huge like Kevin Smith super fan. I saw Mallrats in the theater twice.
Oh,
I had
my
to
God.
Sneak in because wow. I wasn't 18 yet. No,
really,
like, Mike, what were you doing? What was this?
But you were not alone. I mean, he was very much, you know, he was kind of tip of the spear of that indie American movie moment. I mean,
and it's sad that we don't have that anymore. Close. So, yeah. Like, structurally, I'm all for it, but it's, like, the movies themselves, my God.
The two things I was super into at the time was the television of Joss Whedon and the films of John Lasseter, and neither of those, that's not a thing I feel.
Done.
They've aged perfectly. What are you talking about?
They've aged perfectly. Actually, like, the actual movies and like, Buffy are still, like, very good. It's just, like, you have to, like, qualify them when you talk about
Absolutely.
Them, you know?
Absolutely. But
I do think there's something so sad about, because J.K. Rowling has done this too, about these communities that form around works of art. And then the artists just like fuck it up for everybody. It's like breaking up. They end up breaking up these communities with their like stupid bullshit. And it's sort of like, well, now you've made me feel complicated about this thing that I used to love. And like whatever the problems in the actual work are, it's like you've now made me have to do these like 55 like fucking asterisks. Whenever I talk about it, I'm like, not endorsing her personal views, blah, 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 blah. But it's just like, yeah, I wish when people made really like canonical works that they would somehow find a way to just go away and log off.
The fucking thing.
Like, don't give me any more information about yourself.
The thing about George Lucas is that like he gave away a lot of his money to good causes and now just lives in the woods and is quiet. And every so often people are like, what do you think about Star Wars? And he's like, I don't know. I made a lot of money selling it. And you're like, thanks, George. Good for you. The thing I feel luckiest about is that I am just young enough to have read all the Harry Potter books when they came out and just old enough to have not made them my whole personality.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I read them.
Too. Yeah.
I'm glad I read them. I'm glad I don't care about them that much.
Yeah. I don't need to save them or like keep them this whole perfect thing. If I have kids, I probably wouldn't do the Harry Potter books. I don't know. Other people I know do the Harry Potter books with their kids. I don't particularly care, but it's like, I don't have like a deep attachment to them.
I never read them. And then
read the Harry Potter books on this podcast.
Yeah, next podcast, just an audiobook of all the Harry Potter
books. I never read them. And then I was tempted to read them right before the shit hit the fan with all of her nonsense. And I was like, great, now I don't have to read them. I mean, like,
I love that you're like, because that like happened in 2019, 2020. Like, trans people knew she was a TERF before that, but that was just because of what she liked on Twitter. It was easy for people to tap out of that until
the
she started.
Age moment.
Talking. Yeah. And like,
It was really right around the pandemic.
It's
so like,
funny to me that you were like,
books?
Should you read all? That's what a time to get into Harry Potter.
And I was like, should I read them? And I have lots of friends that love them. And I was like, maybe I should read them. And then that all happened. I was like, nah, I guess I don't have to read them.
I feel like the Joss Whedon stuff is harder because it's like the actual production of the show is now the source of the toxicity and not necessarily like things extra to the show. Yeah. So it's like because I also loved Buffy when I was growing up. I pretended because I was a deeply closeted gay teenager and I pretended like, oh, the Buffy, like she's super hot. I'm watching because like she's so hot. And then even my straight guy friends were like, dude, no, you're watching it because of like the quips. Come on, we all know the dialogue is what's getting you there. But then now it's you look back on it and it's clearly was created out of like a deeply toxic environment, which just like makes you feel weird about it now.
Well, the other two, which happened, you know, the creators of the other two the other day, the television show, and I just remember thinking to myself like. In 2023, we're still doing this? Like, it's
wait, what did they do? I didn't even know about those.
Emily, do you?
They, this was sort of gossip or like I had heard it when I was just working in journalism. So it was kind of like they are just very, they were just very toxic, cruel people. Like, not in the
when
sense
they were
of
doing SNL, right?
When also on the other two. And like the thing about the other two is that it became the text of the show. It was about these people who desperately wanted to be famous and that turned them into toxic assholes. And the people who sort of told informed this Hollywood Reporter piece that came out last week were like, yeah, that was just the creators of the show. They wanted to be famous, but they ended up being stuck as writers. And so they became toxic to everyone around them. And they had a bunch of HR complaints. This is all based on a Hollywood Reporter story. But yeah, it's
which in, you know, not in their defense, but these various HR things did not come to pass, which is that essentially there was no charges laid and there wasn't anything that actually came of it. But it's sort of a known thing. I didn't know this. And this is also like, I mean, comedy rooms just sound terrible. Comedy rooms just sound bad.
Yeah, I don't know why it's a requirement that everybody has to be mean to each other to write comedy. I don't get it. It's like, well, the environment in the room, like, why?
I think comedy people in general, and I don't want to speak with too broad a brush, but like if you look at comedians and you look at people who write comedy, there's this like big void inside them that is filled with people's laughter. And I think that they don't know how to really communicate or deal with their sort of emotions. And it's not to say that drama rooms can't be toxic as well. There are many that have been. But this is all just a long way of saying that I just think it's interesting that in 2023, even in the current landscape where everyone knows that someone's going to go to HR and they're going to complain about what you're doing, they're still doing it. It's crazy.
Yeah, why can't people do things alone, like podcasters, and just hate themselves? Hate themselves all day long.
Podcasting, externally. An industry that has famously never had any problems with sort of thing.
I'm racking my brain right now. No, everything's fine. Everything's fine in there. Let's not Google. Just don't type that into Google. But I'm sure it's totally chill and fine.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for coming to talk with us about School Ties.
Thank you for finding a way to not talk about this movie.
Yeah, I mean, listen, we've become very good at it.
That's what we all wanted to do.
It's perfect. But where can people find you? If you want people to find you, where can they listen to you?
If Books Could Kill and Maintenance Phase, you can, I guess, Google to those.
Let me just say, If Books Could Kill, like, instantly one of my favorite podcasts. I know that, like, everybody says that, but I just am overwhelmed at how good it is.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's and you're on Twitter, right? I mean, unfortunately, or fortunately.
I gotta get off of there. Every day I'm like, why am I still on this indefensible
Phil, website? By the time this episode comes out, it may not exist.
That's a good point.
Dude, I had a thing the other day where like they had some sort of technical error and I couldn't log in. Yeah. And you know, other people, like people have been like getting suspended and banned from Twitter for kind of arbitrary reasons. And I was like, oh, I hope it happened to me. Please let there be some bullshit that Elon latched onto that, like, I've broken the terms of service. I want the decision to be taken out of my hands and just like, I'm not on there anymore. But then it turned out to be some dumb error. And then I'm fucking on there tweeting about the goddamn New York Times op-ed page, which is my entire personality at this point.
I mean, listen, it's a good personality. If people aren't following you on Twitter, they should be. You're saying lots of things that need to be said.
True. You're on Blue Sky as well, right?
Yeah. Okay, I'm cool. Skeeting. I'm also skeeting. People say that about me. People have been saying that about me for years.
I can't believe that skeets are the thing that it's, I mean, fucking hell, man. What a world we live in.
A thing, a word that is going to become normal. A skeeter. I'm a skeeter. Yeah.
I don't think we can do anything better than I'm a skeeter. So for that, I think that's how we should end this. But truly, thank you so much, Michael. This was wonderful.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Right. Bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye, guys.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.